our next question, our next applicant, basically original feature for today. Wayne Kosky is going to give us a tutorial on full-scale aircraft crash impact tests and their relevance to 9/11. Wayne, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Ken. I was intrigued over the years by looking at the list of things that are topics associated with the teleconference at the bottom of the list. And I saw that there was full-scale, there was a crash test was one of the topics. As I began noticing that there were, in fact, historical crash tests a few months ago, I had was unaware of them other than the Sandia one. I decided that I would kind of look into them, and I found that there was some that there was not just one, but there was quite a few of them. And that what I wanted to do was pull together a kind of a compilation of them and see what I could see about the issues that might be relevant to 9/11. There, of course, nothing is ever going to be quite right. And then we hear that Paul Salo. So let me just also tell you that I have put together a PowerPoint slide. It's in a PDF format, and there's a link to it in the agenda. I updated it Monday night to correct a link and to also add a short little section to it. So I'm going to be mentioning slide numbers. Because of the format, not all the slides have numbers on them. So let's begin. So on slide two, we've got the table of contents. There's a 9/11 redo initiative. I'm going to touch on four plane crash tests, and there are the 1964 crash test of a DC-7. A 1965 crash test of a Lockheed Constellation, an 84 crash test of a Boeing 720, and the 1988 crash test of a Phantom F4 that many of you probably know. So, slide four, again, this is because many people have suggested replicating the plane crashes on 9/11 or some portions of it. To determine whether destruction can be replicated, Can planes penetrate steel structures, for example, the Twin Towers, survivability of wings after hitting light posts. Crash tests, large full-scale crash tests are considered expensive and practical and possibly would not actually provide a resolution to the issues. Historical plane crash tests are informative in what they have found out from them and how and what could possibly go wrong. The 9/11 redo initiative may try to replicate some of the 9/11 events. Slide five is a partial list of some of the full-scale crash tests. These are ones in which the effect of splashing and misting fuel, how that would contribute to fires and damage, are listed here. So you can see there's quite a history of full-scale crash tests, and so I'm only going to touch on a couple of those. And I have links scattered throughout the PowerPoint to let you dig in deeper if you're interested. Slide seven is the beginning of the 9/11 redo announcement. Paul Salo wants to hire a team to fly a 747 or something like that into a steel frame building and see what the impacts would be. He launched this several months ago, and with the hopes of being able to accomplish some demonstration and see what can happen. Slide eight tells us that the goal is to really see what's going to happen. He's looking for $300,000 at a minimum, and other people have suggested he's looking for $1.5 million to faithfully recreate some of the events of 9/11 with a single test. Slide nine, he has launched an initiative on Indiegogo. It was taken down once it hit the press that he was doing this, and he's tried to move around to different funding sources, and apparently everywhere he's gone has been turned down. Slide 10 is an update from about a month ago. I don't see anything much more recent than that about his activities. But he says banks and all the payment gateways are making it really difficult, and I think he's down to bitcoins, things like that. Well, that's the end of the 9/11 redo, and so slide 11 is the introduction to the 64 crash test of a DC-7. The DC crash test.
Excuse me, just a second. I'm sorry. Listen, somebody's running something in the background, making noise. Would everybody please just star six your phones, and that way there won't be any background. And then when you want to come back in, star six if you want to get in a discussion afterwards. Okay, star six, please, everybody. Thank you.
It could have been my fan, the fan on my computer here. We'll see if it's quieter now. So the DC crash test objectives, as are most related to these full-scale crash tests, are occupant survivability, to document the plane damage upon impact, and to look at things like what happens if you crash into trees. The DC-7 was a transport aircraft built and designed in the early 50s. Slide 13. DC-7 is about half the size of a Boeing 757. There's some dimensions here. I don't need to go through them. But it's about half the size and a much slower plane than a 757. 14. The key observations of this crash test related to 9/11 is that the wing impacts two wood telephone poles. The outer pole is 12 inches, and it severs the wing about 12 feet in where it impacts. The inner pole, which is 13 inches, was severed by the wing. And we'll see that. I'll be focusing in on that because I thought that was really fascinating that they actually had a video of this. The wing was crushed back about 3 feet to the leading spar when it fractured the pole. And it's the wood pole is, of course, similar to the Pentagon tree in column 16 that was sheared off with the remnants of the shattered stuff remaining in the ground. Slide 15 is a slide of the fuel tank locations. This particular aircraft had a very large end-of-wing tank. Slide 16, the DC-7 is, again, much smaller. It destroyed the wood pole that was close in. The damage to the wing from a less than 0.2-inch thick aluminum streetlight poles would be much less than the wood pole. Again, I mentioned this, the tree, column 16. So if we go on to slide 17, and there's probably about a dozen slides, there's a number on the top left with a timing. I don't know if what I'm recording and talking about here is actually full-time, but on the video, it's these are about half-second steps from the video. And I'm just going to pace through them. So the front one is just showing the plane approaching, showing pole one and pole two. Front two, it begins to impact some of the stuff that they put in front of it to damage the engines. Slide three, it's just moving along. It's on a rail. It's not actually flying. So it's very carefully orchestrated for what it's going to hit. Slide four, front four, it's still coming, still more debris is flying around as it's impacting stuff. Slide five, more of the same. Slide six, more of the same. Slide seven, front seven, it now impacts the pole one off the left-hand side. And you're going to see the wing is going to be sheared off at the end. Pole two has not yet hit. Front eight, the wing is now sliced through by the pole on the left. Pole two has not yet hit. You can see what the top of the pole is. And now you can see the top of the pole has been moved on slide nine, front nine. Front ten, the wing is actually flipped upside down. The wing end is flipped upside down because it's no longer connected, but still has forward momentum. Pole 2 is swinging back down because it's been severed. Front 11 is just the next step. And then after that, we get to the image where we have the wing as a side view. And so what we're going to see here, again, it's about another dozen slides. I'm going to go through this mostly pretty quick. But the one that says wing initial is just showing the camera. As we go to wing 02, the designation in the top right-hand corner, you can see pole 1 coming. This is going to impact the outer wing. Wing 02, the wing 3, you can see the shadow of the pole, but you can't see the pole because it's now kind of underneath. You can see the next one, wing 4, you can still see pole 1 shadows are visible. Wing 5, you start to see more dark stuff as the wing is sliced. Wing 6, more things are starting to spray out. Wing 7, the next one, not much else has changed. Wing 8, I've marked out where the pole is. Wing 9, we're approaching the pole 2. You can see the shadow in the foreground. Wing 10, the shadow is getting closer. Wing 11. Now, I've got some markings at the top here that shows in each of the quarter seconds where that pole should be. But it's not going to be there because, some of them, because it's going to have been pushed after being broken. So wing 11 is where we're at. Next one, wing 12. The pole is now about ready to impact the leading spar. It is now impacted. It's still upright. It's still where it moves as far as it's supposed to have. The next one, wing 13, you can see that it hasn't moved where it's supposed to, meaning that the bottom has been kicked out and pushed forward. And wing 14, you can see that the pole has been shattered and is tipping. Wing 15, the same. It's all being destroyed. Wing 16, you can see more of the same. Wing 17, some of the pieces are still there, but the wing is still attached. Wing 18, more of the shadow. Now, that was probably the most dramatic set of photos. I thought they were pretty fascinating. The next section is on slide 46. It's a 1965 Lockheed Constellation. It's really very similar, so there's really, it doesn't have as much detail. So I'm just going to be going through this one rather quickly. Slide 47, the Lockheed Constellation is about three-quarters the size of a Boeing 757. The dimensions are, the statistics are on slide 47 for you to look at. The slide 48 talks about the observation. The right wing impacted the telephone poles. They nearly shattered the outer wing panel, the outer one, and the inboard one remained attached to the fuselage. The number 3 engine remained attached to the fuselage throughout the crash. Again, the documentation of the crash test at the link below. The key observations for slide 49 is that a plane impacting something as massive as a wood pole, a 12-inch tree, can shatter them, similar to the 1964 DC-7 crash test. Both reports were published in 1965. They're companion reports, effectively, and so it's a little confusing as to what year they are. I've referred to this one as 64, so that's when it actually occurred. The Lockheed tanks are shown on the slide 60, where the fuel tanks are. Again, what they would have done is put different liquids in there just to, so that they could study where that liquid went. And this shows where the poles went through the when the plane passed by them. The next slide 51. These are, again, half-second specs, and I'm just going to go through them. There's really nothing much of great merit to these, except they're yet another example of a plane severing wood poles. So the one called at 00 is the beginning. Half-second steps, it's 51. It gets closer, impacts. At 1.0, it impacts the outer one, starts to shear off the pole. Pole hasn't moved. In 149, it has moved, hasn't yet impacted the closer in pole. 2 seconds it has just begun, at 2.51 seconds, you can see, and beyond, you can see that the pool is starting to, has been crushed and is falling down. And I'm just going to skip through those. Just for reference, because we talked about the location of fuel tanks, the Boeing has surge tanks that are at either end. They're about 11 feet into the wing from the wingtip. Just to get a better sense as to where the fuel tanks are. Going on to slide 65, the 1984 crash test, that's a Boeing 720. It was remotely controlled into a barren patch of desert, and the whole purpose, again, was to look at the anti-misting fuels to see what the impacts would be. This showed how difficult it is to do a remote-controlled, at least with the technology that was available in 1984. In the slide 67, again, it was designed to, this tells you what the purposes were, improve crash protection and reduce post-crash fire hazards were the main impetus for it. The slide 68 has some crash objectives. All these things are highly instrumented, and I don't think I need to say any more about this. Slide 69, the key observations for 9/11. Again, the plane approached the ground at a shallow, in this case here, the plane approached the ground at a shallow angle, very much like the large plane that is, people saw at the Pentagon. So it's approaching the ground at a shallow angle. The ground effect did not prevent the plane from approaching the ground. Wing flaps were down, which increases the ground effect. The slower speed increases the ground effect. The plane descended smoothly below its half wing length that some people say is really important, and it slid on the underside of the plane upon hitting the ground. Moving on to slide 70, it's the beginning of the images. This shows the shallow angle approach above a flat ground surface. These don't have any specific markings on them, so I'll just go to slide 71. It shows that the plane altitude is now about a half wingspan above the flat surface. The next slide says the plane is less than half wingspan above the flat surface. The next one shows talks a little bit about ground effect. It does not push the port wing up to the level the plane up. The ground effect were a strong force that becomes exponentially greater as the wing approaches the ground. As some suggest, the port wing should not be able to drop closer to the ground than the starboard wing without a large force from the control surfaces. And what I've done is I've tried to draw some of the vectors in, saying that if they were so much stronger on the port wing, the plane should have been forced up, but it is not. And you can see how this, you can see it in the video if you go to the link. The next slide, the wing, very far end of the wing touches the ground. The ground effect obviously didn't keep the plane level. The next slide, you're starting to see damage to the wing and kicking up of a lot of dust. The next slide shows that the ground effect, my comment is the ground effect cushion of air does not prevent shallow angle impact above a flat ground surface. So that's most of what I wanted to show. But I also did a few days ago, got into a discussion about the yaw motion as a result of a plane impacting with unequal forces. And so I did I looked at what happened if you looked at the tail of this plane, how much would it rotate? This may or may not be relevant. There are some things that I think are important about it. I can talk about that later, but I'll just scan through this pretty quickly. It's a series of pictures, and if you go to slide, the first one, you'll notice that I put a little red mark on the tail and a number one.
Let me let you know you're at 18 minutes, okay?
Okay, I'm doing okay.
Well, you want to leave a little time for questions and answers, all right? Okay.
Well, thanks, Ken. So this is the slide has the number one on it with a red marking for the where the tail is located. The next one is just showing where it is on slide two. A little bit later, the one with the marking three is just a little bit later. Slide four, you can just scan through till we get to slide seven, or the marking. And then the last one just basically shows that just how much a free body can rotate with a relatively minor impact on one side of the wing. If you go from points of four to six, what you see is that there's a significant rotation visible on the plane. And in this case here, the engine on the opposite side was not at full power. When you get to point seven, it's almost sideways, but the plane's also moving to the left, so it's not as useful. And that's what I wanted to show on that. Now I want to move on to the 1988 Phantom F4. Most of you have seen this one. This is slide 86. The test parameters were that the Phantom F4 was intended to impact a concrete block. The Phantom is 19 tons. It's had a 480-mile-an-hour impact speed. The block is reinforced concrete, 23 square feet and 12 foot thick. Total mass of almost 500 tons. It's placed on air bearings to allow the block to accelerate upon impact with the exchange of momentum. Slide 88. The results were that when it was crashed into the concrete block, there were no weak spots, and so the block remained solid. The penetration depth was less than 2.25 inches for the engine itself, and the block moved about a foot during the impact time period, and then it continued to slide further. You'll see that in the images. Slide 89 is looking at the Pentagon wall. I want to get a feel for the different mass here. The Pentagon wall had 24% open space, which is where the glass was. Slide 90 is some calculations where I come up with an approximate estimate of the 80 feet of opening on the first floor, being about 96 tons of wall material, which is about one-fifth the Sandia block, just so we can just to see what the transfer momentum might look like. Slide 91, key observations related to 9/11. I think they're actually really limited with this particular case because you had an F4 with 17% of the mass at a speed that was comparable to a large plane impact, but it hit a solid concrete block, five times more masses, so it's like a lightweight hitting someone on the defensive team of the Seattle Seahawks. There was confetti-like debris from the F4 impact. The solid concrete block required that all debris get reflected back. The Pentagon wall, if it broke as it appears, the plane mass would have entered the building and not so much mass would have been reflected back. Slide 92. Actually, I think this is kind of redundant. I will skip slide 92 and proceed to slide 93. One of the most interesting things that I found in looking at this was the momentum airflow in the wake of the aircraft. Cameras were set up in many different angles, not just the one that we typically have seen, and the momentum of the air mass impacting the wall, creating upward and outward dispersion of debris is in all directions is clearly visible. It illustrates the reasons for a Pentagon fireball and northward distribution of the debris towards the heliport. That's because the airflow behind the plane impacts the wall area, can't go through it, and so it goes upward and outward and creates a fireball. And you can see the similar impacts or similar effects in these examples here. So moving on to the images, this is the first one, slide 94, has the initial block location. I show 1 foot markings. Moving through these quickly, slide 95 just shows the F4 beginning to impact. Slide 96, it's starting to impact. Momentum hasn't yet been accelerated the large block. Slide 97, You can see that most of the momentum has now been transferred. There's not much left on slide 97. By slide 98, you can see that the block is has pushed forward about one of those markings, about 1 foot. And slide 99 is moved almost fully a foot. Now, what I want you to observe is the debris from this is being scattered in all different directions, upward and outward, and that is because of the airflow behind the plane rushing in and doing the dispersal. Had this impacted a solid concrete block in space, it would have just crunched up on it with very little reflected back, and it certainly would not have had the upward and outward direction. Slide 100 is, shows, this is my, I think this is my last slide, shows the one of the most fascinating images of this, and it shows that the trailing air mass had come in and is, in fact, the I've illustrated the physics of it because you can't see the air, but it's coming in at on the order of 480 miles an hour in the rear end, and it is hitting the wall and going off in all directions. So I thought that was one of the most interesting videos, and the link there so you can see it in more detail if you want. I'll take questions now. I've gone through an amazing number of slides. Hope I didn't lose y'all. So I'll take questions.
Okay, one moment, please. Okay, thank you, Wayne. Before we go to the questions, first of all, are Jim Fester and Dennis Camino on the call?
Yes, I'm here, Dennis Camino. I'm here.
Dennis, you're here. Is Jim Fester here? Star 6 if you muted, Jim. Star 6.
Okay. Also, I need to ask who joined the call recently that hadn't been part of the call before. We have somebody that joined a half an hour ago or so. Who was that?
Hey, Mike Cook here.
Mike Cook, okay. And who joined more recently?
Well, I'm how's recently?
Roger.
I mean,
Roger. Who?
Roger.
Yeah, I know Roger. You rejoined. Who joined the call that wasn't part of the call before?
It wasn't a half hour. It was just like 10 minutes, maybe.
Okay. Well, who joined the call a half an hour ago? Well, I guess that's a missed call. I'm not sure. Okay, so. All right, so we'll take questions and comments on Dwayne's presentation. Who would like to be on the stack?
Barbara,
who else?
Xander?
I'd like to also ask questions, but let Barbara go ahead.
I'm sorry, Barbara, Xander, who else? Who else? Barbara, Xander? Okay, I thought somebody else was talking to you. All right, we only have... a few minutes, a couple of minutes actually. So, Barbara, please keep it brief, and Xander too. Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay, what I'll probably do after the call and the next day or so is make a list of these, because I probably won't be able to get all of my comments. But one of the main ones is the presentation seems to me to try to have it both ways. That the whole point of the presentation is more or less to support the story of the Pentagon, and you can't use the F4 test, especially the last of the four crash tests. If you notice that this plane, this F4, only got about the penetration of these massive engines relative to the fuselage of the F4. Only got 2.5 inches into the wall. And there was confetti-like debris that was going off in all directions that you can see. So you either have it one way or the other at the Pentagon. You don't penetrate into the Pentagon and have all of this reflected confetti-like debris.
So was that your question?
It's a comment. I mean,
Let me just respond since we don't have a lot of time.
Yeah.
First, you do know that I did put in the presentation that the dimensions for the penetration of the engine being 2.5 inches into a solid concrete block. Remember, this is a solid concrete block. It's not a pentagon, not the Pentagon wall that is made up of 6 inches of limestone, 8 inches of bricks, and 12 inches of concrete with 24% window space, supported only by reinforcements behind the thicker blast-resistant glass.
It's a total of 2 feet,
most of which is crumbly stuff, the bricks and the limestone. The concrete wall is only 12 inches thick. The Sandia block was 10 feet thick.
It was also specifically hardened to withstand precisely such a terrorist attack.
The plane also hit not straight on. I don't want to get into this piece of it. I would like to talk about the plane crash test with Xander next. But the impact that on the Pentagon wall was not straight on. It was sideways in a direction that a truck bomb would not be exerting those kinds of forces. Potentially that was the plan. I don't know. Again, the Pentagon wall is no more than a 2 feet thick, half of which is crumbly, bricks mortared together, and some concrete with very large holes. 24% of that wall space is open. So I'd like to have Xander give the next question, and if we can come back to you, Barbara, because we're running out of time.
I'll give my rebuttal in an email. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara. Xander?
I wanted to comment that the statement about the composition of that section of the Pentagon leaves out the Kevlar jacketing that was added during the renovation. It's visible in photographs.
Exactly. Yes.
And that significantly hardens the outside of the Pentagon. And then in addition to that, I'd also like to state that there's no evidence of wing entry slots to go all the way into the building and no engine penetration points either. And you couldn't get so lucky as to have engines fly through windows here. I mean, you could possibly with one by statistical numbers, but we know exactly where the hole is, which has a structural member hanging down right in the center of it. It would have been swept clean out of the hole if an airliner would have gone through there. But I wanted to reinforce what Barbara said, and I concur with her her statement too. So I'm going to step back here and let other people make their comments.
Well, so Xander, I have to ask for a clarification. When you say that there was a pole right in the middle, you're talking about the small hole on the second floor, not the 80-foot clear stand-to-stand opening on the first floor. Is that right? You're talking about the hole on the second floor?
There's no 80-foot hole in the opening of the building.
That is correct. There's no 80-foot hole, at most 50 feet.
Well, I'll just simply say, you got to look at the pictures. The column is hanging down. It's column 16 is clearly shattered. The thing that looks like the bottom is the shattered tree stump. That I went through that in my January 27th PowerPoint. That if you don't have it, I'll be glad to send it to you again. There is an 80-foot hole, it's there.
I disagree. It's not there.
I disagree as well.
Okay. We don't. Unfortunately, we don't. Yeah. Thank you. We don't have time for the debate, unfortunately, because it would be a very excellent debate. But since that exhausts our stack and exhausts our time, I want to thank Wayne for the incredible effort that he put into preparing this. And we need to move on to our next topic now. In the interest of time, it's over. That's great.
Xander, I didn't get to ask that question. I just wanted to make that comment. That wasn't me asking the question, so that's fine.
Well, wait a minute. That was you. That was you that was just making that comment, wasn't it?
No, it was not.
It was not. It was the previous speaker.
I think what Xander says is he made a comment. He didn't get around to asking the question.
No, I didn't make a comment. My line dropped, and I called back into
the
call.
I heard him call back in. So who was it that made that comment, please, for the record? Who was it that was just talking with Wayne, if it wasn't Xander?
It was Xander.
No, it wasn't Xander. He dropped.
No, it wasn't. My comment has to do with the ground effect and the fact that the plane in the example may have potentially had control turning it to the left, thereby preventing the ground effect. We don't know that. It's a variable that you don't know from your example. That's my only comment.
So I need a clarification. We're talking about the 1984 Boeing 720 that crashed, and that's the one we were talking about, right?
Correct.
Right. And so it was being flown by remote control, but you can look at the video from several different angles. If you go click on it, and what you'll see is that the plane is basically, it's got some momentum, turning to the port side, so it is on the downward. But if there is a significant amount of ground effect, and it's as strong as some people assert, it should be so much greater that it would counteract the control surfaces on the tail, the rudders, and you can actually in the video you can see the any deflection of the control surfaces. And I welcome your rebuttal presentation with this as an example. So with that.
Okay, Wayne. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you again, Wayne, for this effort. And it's time now we move on to
one point of clarification. Who was the speaker before this last speaker? If it wasn't Xander, who was it? Who made the comment?
Xander, were you involved with the previous conference dialogue, and then you dropped off, and then you came back on? Is that what happened?
Negative. I had no input whatsoever regarding the entry hole in the building or any of that.
But you had talked about the reinforcement of the wall and so forth, right?
Correct. I didn't. No, none of that was me.
So that was you, and then you dropped off, and you came back. Okay, thank you.
No. I said it was not me. Not me. Negative.
Well, then we do need to
know. It's Samino doing
that. That's Samino. Okay.
The only thing I rebutted was the size.
It was Dennis Samino. Dennis Samino.
Oh, Dennis. Okay,
We got it. It was Dennis Samino talking while you had dropped off the call, so now we know. Okay, so now we need to move on.